Greetings to the crew of the Gaian Navigation Experiment, to friends, students, and allies scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares or dares to listen. This is your navigator, John Lash, recording on the 19th of February, 2014. I'm calling this NAB briefing 111 rather than part 2 of 110, but it may be considered as the continuation of NAV briefing 110. And the title of this briefing, 111, is Fukushima, Mon Amour. First of all, I want to say that I made an error in describing Melville's novel. I said that the title, Mardi, referred to the main character, who is a sailor who undertakes certain adventures in the South Seas. But in fact, the protagonist or main male character of that novel is never named. And actually, Mardi refers to a group of islands, a colony of islands that he discovers about a third of the way into the book. And those islands are collectively called Mardi. And he has many adventures on those islands and encounters with the king, and a wise man, a wise old shaman named Babalanja. And in fact, that point in the novel where the unnamed sailor arrives at Mardi, among the islands of Mardi, represents a great turn in the narrative. In fact, the novel really consists of two parts. The first third continues to the point where the young sailor meets Yila, the flower maiden, the Polynesian flower maiden. And he actually rescues her from an evil shaman who presumably is preparing her for human sacrifice. And he becomes obsessed with her. They have a passionate and erotic relationship. And yet she remains a mysterious, dreamlike creature, a girl of an artistic spirit, you could say, elusive and strange in her beauty. And the descriptions of Yila are increasingly evasive and mysterious and enigmatic. And finally, she simply escapes. He presumes that she drowns. She simply escapes. And it is after the escape of Yila that the young sailor finds his way to the islands of Mardi. And the remaining two-thirds of the novel has been interpreted variously by different critics. Of course, everyone who's written about the novel has pondered deeply about the symbolism of Yila, as much as they have pondered about the symbolism of the white whale, Moby Dick. Both Yila and the whale are known for their whiteness. But most critics agree that after the first third of the book, the remaining two-thirds resemble more a work of Jonathan Swift, Gulliver's Travels. The tone and language and use of images and personalities appears to verge on a kind of political satire and a commentary upon some of the events of Melville's time. Interestingly, Melville wrote Mardi just a year or two before he wrote Moby Dick, and that was also the year that he got married. And it is said that he wrote a chapter or so every day, and then he would read it to his wife in the evening. So it would seem that the two-thirds of Mardi, the last two-thirds of the novel, that Melville was in a way exposing and expounding his views on various contemporary matters to his wife. And that part of the novel does not have the strong mystical flavor that you find in the preceding third. But then in the end, because the character is continually haunted by the elusive figure of the Flower Maiden, at the end, the theme of Yila returns, and the book ends without a real ending. It ends with the sailor on a perpetual quest to reunite himself with her, with his Polynesian lover, whether it be in death by drowning or whether it be by attaining some sublime supernatural state to which she apparently has access and from which she apparently emerged in the first place. So, correction there. Marty is not the name of the main character. It's the name of those islands. I've seen numerous covers of books, various editions of Marty in various languages, translations including Italian and French. I believe it was very popular among the French crowd at one time, and particularly well-liked by the surrealists, such as André Breton. And so there you had a good many decades prior to surrealism, you had a totally full-blown surrealist novel written by an American, an eccentric American romantic. And Breton even did some art work for the French translation of Marty, I believe, and somewhere in my books, if I can dig it out, I have a copy of the representation of Yila that comes from the hand of André Breton. If I can find that, I'll post it in Celestics or on Gaiaspora.org, or both. So, I'd like to pick up directly on the question of Fukushima. And I'd like to say that I don't want to be mistaken about this matter. I've been reflecting over the last few days. It took me a couple of days more than I would have liked to follow up this briefing 110. And during that time, there's a lot of things happening around here right now, a lot physically. During that time, I reflected back on the 3 years of the GNE going back to May of 2011. And I realized that, of course, that the GNE developed into something of a far greater magnitude than I had anticipated. And I'm really grateful for the way it has developed and for your fidelity in the process of this experiment. I mean, I certainly would have gone insane doing this experiment completely on my own. And even though it is as if I am doing a solo sail around the Earth, a solo circumnavigation, because I keep finding myself alone in this little room, nevertheless, I know I'm not alone, and I know that you're on the journey with me. Otherwise, it would never have been possible for me to sustain it. In the course of this journey, I recognized over the last couple of days, I've introduced some thoughts and some interpretations of various topics that were contemporary with the briefings, and they haven't always been handled so well, and they haven't always been relevant, and I'm sure that I've been off the mark on some of them. But I've also been right on the mark on others. Well, I want to be sure that I'm right on the mark with Fukushima. So I'd like to make, first of all, the following disclaimers. I do not accept Galen Windsor as a totally unsuspicious character. I consider him to be extremely dubious. Nevertheless, you know how it is with disinformation agents. What makes them effective is that part of what they say is true. There are certain things about what Galen Windsor said about the nuclear power industry that I deem to be true. The notion that there is a huge scam about radiation, disease, and the half-life decay of radioactive elements polluting the food chain, mutating DNA, and causing untold illnesses in countless generations of people. The idea that that scam, well, first of all, that it is a scam, and the idea that it's a scam that is used to control nuclear power and to keep the balance of power in the hands of the oil barons makes perfect sense to me. That is exactly how they operate. So the first point of my disclaimer is that I don't accept Galen Windsor as totally legitimate, but I think that some of the things he said are well worth considering. Second disclaimer is I am not in any way a fan or proponent of nuclear energy. I think that the nuclear power plants are horrors upon the face of the earth. I think that they are ridiculously complicated and cumbersome machines. As someone famously said, a very complicated way to boil water. Maybe there is some other way to use nuclear power safely, and maybe Galen Windsor knew about it, or somebody else walking around on the planet today knows about it, but I don't know about it. But in any case, don't take me for a fan or proponent of the nuclear power industry. Bear in mind also that when I think pollution, I think about real environmental pollution, such as the dumping waste into rivers, or polluting the atmosphere with particulate matter, or polluting the food chain with chemicals. Fluoride is a massive substance of pollution on the earth. So nuclear power plants may also generate that kind of pollution, and to that extent they are just as bad and objectionable as any other industry with its massive toxic byproducts, okay? The third disclaimer I want to make is that is can better be described as a confession of my ignorance. I don't know about you out there listening to my words right now, but I don't know what nuclear energy is. I have never been able to grok the atomic model of matter. There are people who say that the atomic model of matter is a complete fraud. Did scientists really split the atom when they ignited the first atomic bomb, the A-bomb? Did Enrico Fermi, when he achieved what is called a nuclear fission at the stadium in Chicago, did he actually split the atom? Is that what they actually did, or is all that a lie? I don't know, because I can't understand what nuclear energy is in the first place. I know what it's supposed to be, but every time I go over that description, my bullshit alarm goes on, and the sign on the wall starts blinking, Mephisto alert, Mephisto alert. So I'm wondering if we have all been conned since 1945 about what is actually the nature of, first of all, atomic bombs and later hydrogen bombs, how they actually work, and what are the long-term effects of their byproducts in the atmosphere. I have to confess that I don't know anything about it. I haven't come up with any satisfactory answers. And that being so, in the void of ignorance, I just find myself considering the possibility that it's not what they say it is. And so what I can say with confidence is this. It does not make sense, and I know why it doesn't make sense in this case. It does not make sense that science could state as a matter of scientific veracity that radioactive elements have these half-lives running into hundreds of thousands and billions of years. It does not make sense. It is not empirical. It's like black holes. You know, many people believe that there are black holes and that there is something called dark matter. And it's been said that 95% of the universe is composed of dark matter. Have you heard that one? Well, I believe that it has been shown by serious and competent people that there are no such thing as black holes. They're an impossibility, that dark matter does not exist, that these weird fictions, which are simply based on mathematical formulas and outrageous assumptions, are terribly erroneous and misleading. I think that the whole notion of the half-life of radioactive elements falls into that category. Now, I have no doubt that some kind of terrifically destructive explosion is produced under the name of nuclear energy or nuclear fission. But what it actually is, I don't know. And what I'm thinking now in regard to Fukushima, in regard to the timing of Fukushima and correction, is really what I'm thinking is precarious, okay? I'm taking a really big chance to elaborate in this way. I feel like I'm walking on very thin ice. Nevertheless, I feel compelled to make this observation. I'll put it in the form of a question. Suppose that there is some kind of energy in the elementary fields of matter, which we would call in terms of socionic cosmology the DEMA, the dense elementary matter arrays. Suppose there is some kind of energy at the elementary level, or atomic level, if you will, which, along with all of the other processes in nature, belongs to the life of the biosphere. So first of all, I ask you if you can allow that that energy, whatever it is, which manifests in itself in what we call radioactivity, is part of the general dynamics of the Gaian superorganism. It's part of her life field. Can you accept that? Second, I want to ask, can you imagine that scientists broke open that field? They gained access to that field without actually knowing what it was. And in doing so, they not only mastered a diabolical tool of destruction, namely the atomic bomb, the hydrogen bomb, they mastered the manufacture of a tool of destruction. Okay, so that is the absolutely horrific, destructive side of nuclear energy. But consider this, at the same time, they tapped into radiation. And suppose that radiation is her process. Well, I have to ask you, whose process would it be if it wasn't hers? I think that the material error in thinking, I like that phrase, the material error in thinking about nuclear energy is due to human egoism on a grandiose scale. We all appear to assume, or to have it suggested to our minds, that the release of nuclear energy through fission producing this radiation, I'm going to call it nuclear radiation, is a feat of human endeavor. But it suppose that it isn't. Suppose that it's something that's present in her life field, and human beings around 1945 just happened to stumble into that field and to gain access to it. Okay, this is not easy, but I'm trying to be really sober in handling this. So bear with me. I think it's tremendously important to look at Fukushima in this way, to ask, maybe Fukushima is there to show us something. Maybe there's something to learn about the Gaian superorganism. Rather than to just say, oh, human animals have done a horrible thing by creating these nuclear power plants, which, when they blow up, release this deadly nuclear radiation into the air. Oh, how horrible. Oh, well, it may be. I'm not saying that it isn't. But what I'm saying is that suppose that radiation is here anyway. Suppose it's here for her to use. Suppose that she uses it to mutate species at those moments when she wishes to reset the experiment. Suppose that the release of this radiation at Fukushima is an integral part of the reset for correction. This is one way to look at it. Now, I realize that some people are going to tear their hair out and scream and say, how can I be so stupid? How could this? What am I, so gullible? How can I? I have to ask myself, am I gullible? Am I just saying, oh, holy shit, I wish it were that. You know, I wish it were that, and rather than what we're told that it is. Because if it is what we're told that it is, by Helen Caldicott and other experts, then we're all cooked. The future generations of humanity are going to be horribly mutated into I don't know what. What does this mutation mean? Well, I guess it means that our genetic processes will be distorted and deformed. We will no longer appear as normally functioning people. We'll appear like thalidomide babies or whatever. We'll have all kinds of neurological and metabolic diseases. The cancer will be off the charts. I mean, this is what we're being told. But as a matter of fact, the events so far that have transpired since 1945 do not necessarily give grounds for those assumptions. In the first place, we've only had about 70 years to observe what the effects of radiation are. But the model says that the effects of radiation go on for hundreds of thousands and millions of years. Well, obviously, that's not a scientific proposition. It cannot be falsified, but neither can it be verified. Now, again, I can hear people screaming and running around, you know, waving their hands and saying that, you know, I've really lost it. Even to speculate in this way, I must be losing my marbles. But just hold on for a minute. I have to ask you, if you object to what I'm saying, and I'm not asking you to accept it, I'm just asking you to consider it. But if you find it totally objectionable and ridiculous, then I have to ask you, do you know what nuclear radiation actually is and what its effects actually have been, its provable effects? There have been thousands of nuclear bombs exploded on this planet, in the South Pacific, in Nevada, in various places around the world, in Siberia. There have been various nuclear accidents, but there has never been a meltdown. There is no meltdown. What is a meltdown? A meltdown would mean that there is a nuclear fission reaction that absolutely cannot be stopped. It's like a continual nuclear explosion, an ongoing nuclear explosion. That's not happening, as far as I know. Is that what's happening at Fukushima? We don't know. And there's another thing I want to say about Fukushima before I get back to my outrageous proposal here. There really must be a Mephisto game going on with Fukushima. Because there's a massive contradiction in the narrative that is maddening. It makes no sense whatsoever. If Fukushima is the danger to all life on Earth, capable of destroying the Pacific Ocean, capable of destroying the food chain in the ocean, capable of doing all the horrible things, short-term and long-term, which have been attributed to it, if that is so, then why is there not a massive international team of observers and workers present in Japan reporting every day on this and working closely at the site to see what can be done, if anything can be done, to contain this the horrific ramifications of this event? Why isn't there a team from Friends of the Earth there? Why are not there marine biologists from the old Jacques Cousteau school? Why isn't there a massive battery of boats with marine biologists from all around the world? Where are all the people? If this is threatening the entire world and the narrative, the official narrative is accepted by scientists and people in universities and people in positions to understand what nuclear energy is, then why aren't they there at least observing it and doing something about it? And why does it happen that the people that we see on the alternative internet who are most known for their reportage and commentary on Fukushima are frauds who have been debunked? Lauren Moret, M-O-R-E-T, Dr. Christopher Busby, whom I mentioned, and even Arne Gundersen. Who are these people? I put a link in the crew notes that I'm sending out to go with this briefing. And one of the links goes to a site dedicated to debunking Fukushima alarmists. It's called educateyourself.org. And the subtitle of the file is Fukushima Radiation PSYOP, 19 May 2012. And if you go and just investigate a little bit, you don't have to really go deeply into it, you'll find, or at least I can say this is what I found, that the three people that are principally known for giving us the genuine scoop as opposed to the official narrative are of very, very dubious character and background and are not who they say they are and do not have any real qualifications. They claim to have qualifications, but upon examination, other people say they don't have these qualifications. You know, we are really in the land of the archons. It is when you cannot tell truth from falsity, when you cannot tell plastic from pearl. And you can't tell the difference. For instance, you can't tell the difference if this long article with many references and many links, which is debunking the Fukushima alarmists and proposing that the Fukushima event is a psyop, the narrative around it is a psyop, excuse me, you can't tell if that debunking document itself is a psyop. You can't tell. This is where we have arrived. This is the wall. This is where the human species hits the wall. I know I'm not being very coherent here, and I wish I could be more sober and calm. But right now, I'm having a certain kind of stress attack lately over the last few days. So I'm not able to be as sober as I would like to be, but this is an extremely sobering subject. And it's an extremely sobering notion, if I may say so, to realize that we, as a species, who are particularly endowed with the need for facts so that we can find evidence in order to prove what is true, don't have the opportunity to do that today regarding the most serious events of our times. If you go back to the Kennedy assassination, you can understand now that the narrative that was put out at that moment on that very day was a lie, and many people had to be murdered, and a lot of things had to be done to maintain that narrative. So many people today would realize that the narrative of that event was a cover-up of the event. The official narrative was a cover-up. And so come forward 50 years from the assassination of JFK now, come forward, fast forward 50 years, and you find films like The Men Who Killed Kennedy and Evidence of Revision. And those films present what the human animal needs. We are rational creatures. Those films present the evidence that can be subjected to a rational process of evaluation to arrive at a conclusion about the truth of what happened. And it's amazing. It's highly therapeutic. It's liberating, I find, to go back to those events and consider them in light of what is now known. I lived through those events, and at the time that they happened, and in the decades subsequent to the Kennedy assassination, I didn't know what had happened. Now I do. Now I am certain that I know what happened, how it happened, who did it, who planned it, because I've seen the evidence. Unfortunately, that is not going to be what is possible with Fukushima 50 years from now. I don't think that's going to be possible because the layers of lies are so thick. And so what do we do? What do we do? This Fukushima event is a massive challenge to what I would call the natural proof-seeking ability of the human animal. You know, in the English language, the word proof and the word truth sound somewhat similar. And those two words go together. You cannot have one without the other. That is what the human animal seeks. It seeks truth about events that happen based on the proof. And what is the proof? The proof is the evidence. Some extremely dedicated people who in many cases risked their lives and who in most cases were not paid for what they did spent years of their life to find the evidence that would prove the truth of the assassinations of JFK, Martin Luther King, and Robert Kennedy. But unfortunately, and it saddens me to say this, I don't think we can expect the same thing to happen today with Fukushima. It may, and it would be great if it did, and it would be great if instead of taking 50 years, it only took 5. That would mean that by 2020, it would be possible for the world to know, if anyone gave a shit, what actually happened at Fukushima and what is actually underway in the natural processes that we call nuclear radiation. And they are natural processes. This is the point that I'm getting. You know, someone wrote me today, this subject, by the way, has triggered some vivid responses from you out there in the crew. It has really pushed some buttons. This subject pushes some buttons. It pushes my buttons, let me tell you. And one member of the crew said to me, well, Reich was probably right about DOR, that is the nature of this radiation. It is deadly orgone energy and so forth. And he, this particular member of the crew, said, I don't believe that it is natural. I believe that it is human-made. I want to find the exact words here. Hold on a second. Quote, I don't believe the transformations / transmutations are natural, Sophianic in parentheses, but are imposed, archontic in parentheses. That's my take on it. And many others among you may feel the same way. But hold on here for a minute. How can the transformations and transmutations and mutations that result from exposure to nuclear radioactivity not be natural? Of course they're natural. What's not natural about them is the way that they have been provoked by human meddling. But what humans have provoked in the form of fissionable atomic energy belongs to nature as much as the air you breathe, as much as the rain that falls out of the sky. And so, if these rays, these phantom emanations of nuclear radiation, have effects upon all that lives, that is because they are part of the natural symbiosis of all that lives. We have not introduced them into the natural world. We simply found them in the natural world. We may be using them incorrectly. We certainly are using them in an extremely destructive way in the form of nuclear warheads and bombs. But the fact that atomic energy is released in a bomb, and I very much am dubious and doubt this description, but let's just take it at surface value. The fact that atomic energy is released in a bomb that is used to destroy and harm people does not mean necessarily that atomic energy is harmful. It has its place in nature. And this is the problem, isn't it? Because you can search far and wide, and I don't think that you'll find anybody, any scientist, any expert, or even any mystic telling you what is the place of radioactivity in nature, in her, on her terms. We didn't invent it. Ever since 1945, the human species has been laboring under the illusion that we created atomic energy. This is ridiculous. Nor did we create the radiation that proceeds from atomic explosions. We did not create that energy. She did. And so the question to ask is, what does she use it for? What is it? Maybe this is the moment to really turn the human mind around and to look at Gaian processes at the most elementary levels of matter, as if seeing it through her mind and her eyes. I do not feel confident about what I'm telling you now, but in a way I do. In an odd way, I do feel confident. Here's one thing I can say of which I feel confident. If nuclear radiation, so-called, is actually a bionic excitation produced by the first attention of the Aeon Sophia, then it must be verifiable as such. And maybe that is the challenge of Fukushima, which I mean to suggest by the odd title, Fukushima Mon Amour. Who is Mon Amour? Well, you know who Mon Amour is. I only have one great love, and so do you. And so, what is the connection between the horror of Fukushima and mon amour, my love, the earth, the planet? Are we to think that the human animal is responsible for a diabolical act of releasing some part of her energy which is destructive to all life? That's one interpretation. But does it necessarily have to be destructive to all life? Before I came across the lectures by Galen Windsor on YouTube, about 2 years ago, I came across a really weird interview with two young Russian people who were eating radioactive elements. They would go out to various sites, I don't know where they were, military sites, so they would scrounge around like people scrounging for food in a dumpster in order to find radioactively contaminated materials, which they were eating. Now, this was extremely bizarre, and I considered it to be a fraud, and I'm still not entirely sure that it isn't. But let me put this to you, my friends. Suppose that it is a fraud. It may not make any difference whether it's a fraud or not, as long as you learn something from it that you need to learn. So that couple may be a fraud. They were interviewed by Stuart Sverdlov, who is, to me, a crackpot that I absolutely do not trust. But even crackpots who are untrustworthy can be sincere human beings who at times stumble upon some truth that they conscientiously attempt to share with the rest of the species. This is the state that we have arrived at. We are never going to be able to sort truth from falsity at the culmination of the work of the Archons. And the only solution to find the truth is to stay in your love for the earth. Fukushima, mon amour. Because love is cognitive. And in your love for the earth, you might be able to get your mind geared to the possibility that what is said to be lethal long-term radiation exposure is actually a bionic excitation that she induces to produce the mutation of species. And what is this mutation word? What is the mutation word? What is the connotation of the mutation word? Well, it's a horrible word. It's a horror word, right? Horror, zombies, mutations. Look at the horrible creatures that we're pulling out of the sea and all the starfish are melting and species collapse a lot. Species collapse all the time. And remember also that correlation is not causation. Scientists who spoke, who warned that humanity and all life on Earth are entering the sixth extinction some years ago already, decades ago, really, those scientists alerted the world to the fact that we are living in a period when there are massive extinctions of species taking place. Well, that was well before Fukushima, wasn't it? And so now, what are we going to do? Are we going to look at what's happening in the Pacific Ocean and what's happening on the west coast of the USA and elsewhere around the world? And we're going to blame it all on Fukushima? Well, correlation is not causation. It's easy to correlate things to other things. It's a predictable human habit to make correlations. And yet, it can be argued that some of the so-called effects of Fukushima, which are occurring today, health effects could be due to other things and not necessarily due directly to radiation exposure from Fukushima. And as far as I know, that has not yet been proven to be the case. Now, that point reminds me of the interview with Christopher Busby to which I referred. Now, I have to say that I can't find this interview again, but I did find an interview with him on Alex Jones on January 9th. It's not the one in which Busby admits that he's baffled and he discloses, significantly to my mind, he discloses that we haven't actually scientifically proved causation regarding some of the things that we are attributing to Fukushima. So anyway, you may want to look at that interview. I'm posting the links in the crew notes I'm sending out for NB111. And right underneath that, you'll have the link to the long and carefully sourced article that indicates that Busby is a fraud. But even from the mouth of frauds can come to truth. How do we get to the truth about our world at a time when the human species is deeply and terminally enmeshed in fraud? Well, the touchstone of all truth for our species is the Earth. And that applies as well to the truth about what is happening at Fukushima, Mon Amour. Now, some of you might know that that title of this briefing is a play on the name of a movie, Hiroshima, Mon Amour. Now, this movie, which is quite a famous movie of the Nouvelle Vague of the French cinema, the New Wave French cinema, is a drama, a romantic drama, made by Alain René, with a screenplay by Marguerite Duras. Duras was quite an excellent and well-known French novelist and scenarist. This film was made in Hiroshima in 1959. That is to say, 14 years after the bomb. And it contains some documentary footage of people who suffered from radiation burns and people who were there in the immediate wake of the bomb. And so you see these typical images of horror, the skin falling off, the hair falling out, and so forth. People have radiation disease. You see a Japanese woman combing her hair and the hair coming out in her comb. But those effects of radiation sickness apply to the people who were exposed to the blast. You don't find that people living in Hiroshima, which was already a thriving city, rebuilding itself 14 years later, you don't find them combing their hair out and having it fall out, do you? You don't find them walking around with radiation sickness, do you? You don't find them dying and folding over because of the effects of the long-term effects of the phantom radiation in the air after the bomb. Do you? No. In fact, they thrived, and they continued to thrive until this day. And as far as I know, there is not some extraordinary or elevated rate of death due to continuing after effects of radiation at Hiroshima. The evidence is not there. It's simply not there. So even though nuclear bombs are one of the consummate horrors that human beings have ever created on this planet, it does not necessarily follow that nuclear radiation is what we have been told to believe. And I'm beginning to wonder, really wonder, if the timing of Fukushima, with correction, may not be one of the greatest lessons in duplicity. that comes out of the GNE. Consider that Jupiter is now in the twins. I was looking at it about an hour ago. It was directly at the apex over the house here. Crystal clear evening. The night sky black as onyx or ebony. The brilliant figure of Orion high in the sky. And to the left of Orion, Jupiter in the twins. The twins have a connotation of duplicity, which is a form of evil and manipulation. But the twins also have a connotation of doubling. And let's add to the themes of the twins, the theme of a Janus-like power, a power that has two faces, destructive and regenerative. It's obvious, and the evidence is there, as seen in the documentary clips in Hiroshima Mon Amour, that nuclear energy can be extremely destructive when it is made to explode in the form of a bomb. But suppose that coupled with that destruction is a regenerative power. Suppose that the much feared radioactivity has, in Gaia's terms, some kind of regenerative role. Who's to say it doesn't? We haven't been exposed to it long enough to know. The evidence is skewed by the horrific connotations that go along with the word radioactivity, radiation disease, and so forth. But in fact, where is the evidence that radiation has produced massive mutation of our species since 1945? Chernobyl is a thriving place as far as nature goes. And if you look on the links provided for this talk, you'll see that one of them goes to the clip on the women living in Chernobyl. How can they be living in Chernobyl? They've been there since it happened. And their hair isn't falling out. And they're not suffering from symptoms of radiation disease. So what's going on? And tourists go there. Like I said, tourist buses go there all the time. You know, it's horrible. I know it's horrible to consider that I might be fooling myself. This is just exactly what the government wants us to believe, because radiation is a soft kill. It's one of the best things that they've come up with among the globalists, so-called, the New World Order people. It's one of the best things they've come up with to reduce the population. And they would love it if we were to believe that it was harmless. And so, what am I? Am I a shill now? Am I running cover for the nefarious government agencies who really know how deadly radiation is over the long term and would love us to think otherwise? Am I that or am I not that? Well, let me tell you, there is no way to know if I am that or not that. I can tell you that I'm not running cover for those people, but you don't have to believe me, and I can't prove that I'm not. And so, what does it come down to at the end of the day to get at the truth of these matters? It comes down to your cognitive ability through loving the Earth to know how she operates. And we're going to have to go to her directly with our faculties and our ability for proof seeking in order to know the truth about Fukushima, because it's not going to come from anywhere else. And so this is the challenge. I really do believe that this is the immense and incomparable challenge that comes in the GNE right now, coming with the third lesson about duplicity. We might learn in the course of this lesson that nuclear energy is a two-faced genius. It is a two-faced power. It provides, when handled in a certain manner, massive destructive weapons. But on the other hand, it's just her energy after all. And perhaps when it is given back to her, because she handles it now, she uses it for her purposes in a way that may be benevolent to the human species. To assume that it is a malevolent and destructive and harmful energy that she harbors in the material depths of her being is wrong. I believe that assumption is wrong. At best, it would be a good idea to suspend judgment. We don't actually know. Just because the way it was discovered led to its use in a spectacularly destructive manner does not mean that it is, by its nature, destructive. Now, it's also possible that the planetary animal mother, in the framework of her designs and purposes, uses bionic radiation, as I'm calling it, to produce extinctions. The evidence shows that she can produce extinctions without it. Extinctions are happening on a mass scale. To some extent, they may be due to the human impact upon nature, but not entirely. And so the question of the ultimate cause of those extinctions, as well as of our own extinction as a species, remains entirely open. Okay, maybe she's using it to extinct humanity. But if that were the case, it would be her who's doing it, and not the people who released the radiation. And then you're going to say, but wait a minute. If we had never discovered nuclear energy, and if we had never released the radiation in this form, then we wouldn't face the danger of going extinct through exposure to radioactivity. Well, how do you know that? She has her own ways of producing radiation. Called radon is one of them, radon gas. There are natural ways to emanate radiation. And there is a massive increase of the release of radon gas. Even Christopher Busby pointed that out. And I think in that respect, the guy may be genuine. You know, there are a lot of true pretenders in the world. Do you know what a true pretender is? It's someone who's fraud or pretending, but they actually believe themselves to be real. And in the process of believing themselves to be real, they occasionally deliver some truth. And Busby, in the interview that I was unable to find, which may have been taken down, Busby admitted that he recounted an event where someone sent him some reports from the coast of Chile indicating that there were alarming levels of radiation in the water. And Busby shot it down, and I think this is honest. He shot it down, saying he did the research, and it was the presence of these high levels was due to radon and could not be attributed to Fukushima. Again, correlation is not causation. So, if you were to say to me, but John, if we hadn't let this genie out of the bottle and given it the instructions to perform its most evil magic upon the planet, then humanity wouldn't be facing extinction from radioactive exposure right now. Well, how do you know that? You don't know if that's true. We might still be anyway, because it's her energy to do with as she chooses. And this is the lesson. This is one of the lessons I am beginning to feel I am beginning to think, I'm beginning to be convinced that this is one of the big, big lessons of Fukushima. And so to conclude my rant on this, because I call it a rant because it's far from being level-headed and sober as I would wish to be, I'd like to point out to you some particular details about the events of March 2011. These details are privileged intel to those of us in the Gaian navigation experiment. So as you listen to what I'm going to say now, concluding this briefing, I ask you to take a moment and appreciate that privilege. Appreciate the privilege you enjoy to have this extremely rare and precious information, which is evidential. This is proof, or this is evidence that can lead to a proof on the planetary scale. I ask you to recall that the Gaian navigation experiment is based on a concept drawn from Gnostic teachings. According to the Gnostics, at some time in the indefinite future, from their viewpoint in time, more than 2,000 years ago, the Aeon Sophia would enter an event called Diorthosis. This is Sophia's correction. That is evidence. That is textual evidence. You can go to the Nag Hammadi materials. You can find that word, Diorthosis. Only you'll only find it a couple of times, maybe three. And in my commentaries on the Gnostic writings that survive, you will see how I fit the concept of correction into the Sophianic narrative. This is all evidential. This is all a body of evidence leading to the proof of something. In the spring of 2011, in March of that year, two remarkable things occurred that were known to the entire world. One was the earthquake that caused the disaster at the nuclear power plants in Fukushima. That earthquake occurred at 3:37 p.m. on March the 11th. Mark that date, March the 11th. 3-11-11, if you will. In the same time period, but some few days later, on the 19th of March, there occurred a supermoon. And this was an event observed by many, many people around the world. It was a full moon that occurred when the moon was in its perigee, its point closest to the Earth. And although the moon passes through its perigee once every month, it does not always do so at the moment of full moon. When that occurs, the moon appears to be particularly large, anomalously large, because, of course, it is located closer to the Earth at that moment. And that particular supermoon was a subject of enormous attention and interest throughout the entire world. But only you and the navigator connected those two events. So let me tell you exactly how they are connected. And in turn, you yourself can infer how they are connected to Sophia's correction. The moment of the lunar apogee in March 2011 was on the 6th of March. And around 8 a.m. on the 6th of March, the moon passed through its apogee, that is to say, its point most distant from the Earth, which was located at that time in 1 or 2 degrees Aries, very close to the vernal point. Then, 13 days later, it was in its perigee around 19 hours, 7 in the evening, and that was the moment of the supermoon. Now remember the concept of the barycenter. B-A-R-Y-C-E-N-T-E-R. What is the barycenter? Well, it is the center of the shared mass of the material body of the Earth and the material body of the Moon. Because the material body of the Earth is preponderantly so much heavier and more massive than the material body of the Moon, the barycenter is displaced toward the center of the Earth by a factor of 1 to 81. And so imagine a bar connecting the center of the material globe of the Earth to the material globe of the Moon. Just imagine a long metal bar. And then imagine a point on that bar, like a joint, like a round sphere on the bar. That point is the barycenter, and it is located actually inside the Earth, within the material globe. But it is always positioned directly under the Moon. So if you are standing out at night and you see the Moon go overhead, you look straight up looking south and you see the Moon overhead, the barycenter of the Earth-Moon system at that moment is beneath your feet. Now recall that I have explained that many years ago when I was in Los Angeles, I used to talk to people at JPL in Pasadena, the Jet Propulsion Lab. I asked them certain questions about the apogee and the perigee of the Moon and how they could be calculated and things of that sort. That was the time in my studies, around 1976, when it came to my attention that the barycenter of the Earth-Moon system actually travels around a circuit inside the Earth. It tunnels around the Earth once a month. You can imagine it like a locomotive in a subterranean passageway. And it's chugging and chugging around the Earth. And it was at that time, as I undertook those studies, that I came upon the remarkable fact, at least it was to me remarkable, and this is all factual evidence, my friends. This is scientific. This is astronomy. This is empirical science. It came to my attention that the velocity of the barycenter as it circled around the interior of the Earth changed. Sometimes it moved faster and sometimes it moved slower. And when I observed the range of that velocity, I saw that at its highest velocity, the very center approached the speed of sound, which is about 767 miles per hour, or about 1 mile in 5 seconds. Okay, so you have the concept of the barycenter inside the Earth, and you have the concept of it going faster during part of its circuit and slower during the other part. Now the question arises, well, when does it move faster? And why? And when does it move slower? What causes the barycenter to approach a velocity close to the speed of sound? Well, when it has further to go, it has to move faster. That is to say, when the barycenter is further from the center of the Earth, it has to move faster than when it is closer to the center of the Earth, because the circle it makes when it's further from the center of the Earth is larger. Okay? So the next question is, well, when is the barycenter in its monthly circulation around the center of the Earth further from the center? And that is when the Moon is further out in its orbit, because the Barry Center is manipulated by the moon rather in the form of a plunger. At some moments, the plunger is drawn out and upward toward the surface of the Earth to a depth of about 1,000 miles, I believe. And that's the moment when the moon is at its apogee, more distant from the Earth. That's the moment when the Barry Center would reach its highest velocity. 2 weeks later, when the moon is closer to the Earth because it's in its perigee, it drives the piston of the Barry Center in toward the center of the Earth. It consequently has less distance to move, and it consequently moves more slowly. Well, going back to those years, the mid-70s in L.A., I began to live with a question in my mind. What would happen if the Barry Center at some moment exceeded the speed of sound? Well, that moment would have to be when the moon was either approaching or coming out of its apogee, wouldn't it? Now let's go back to March 2011. The moon went through its apogee, most distant from the Earth, on March 6th. Fukushima happened 5 days later, on the 11th, and I designated the initial moment of correction to be 8 days later, on the 19th, the moment of the supermoon. Now, just consider what is odd about me doing that. Actually, at the moment of the supermoon on the 19th, when the moon was in its perigee, the Barry Center was actually moving at its least velocity. But I claimed, as the basis of the Gaian navigation experiment, that the reset to correction began when the Barry Center exceeded the speed of sound. Well, it wouldn't have exceeded the speed of sound on the 19th, would it? It had to have exceeded the speed of sound sometime around the 6th, when the moon was passing through its apogee. So, should I have said that reset for correction began on March 6th, because that was the moment when the moon was at its apogee and the velocity of the Barry Center was at its maximum? Maybe I called it wrong. But consider the sequence of these three events and how they fit together. Imagine that the moon reached its apogee on March 6th, and indeed, the velocity of the Barry Center exceeded the speed of sound. And so, consequently, a rotation, an acoustic impact expanded from the interior of the Earth outwards. What caused the Fukushima nuclear plant disaster on March 11th? Some people say there was a submarine earthquake, a disruption of two tectonic plates off the coast that caused the consequent tsunami that destroyed those plants. Well, what caused that disruption of tectonic plates? Now, you can go on the alternative internet and you can find a lot of discussions about that, can't you? And there are numbers of people who claim that the event that caused the destruction of those power plants, the nuclear accident, as it were, was a man-made event. And so it has been attributed to mini nukes buried in the ocean and various other things, okay? Suppose, however, that it was not a man-made event, Suppose that the tectonic submarine event that caused the Fukushima accident was due to the barycenter of the Earth-Moon system exceeding the speed of sound. Then you would have to say that it was the Aeon Sophia herself who caused the tectonic event that destroyed the Fukushima plant. And so, March 6th, maximum velocity of the barycenter. 5 days later, the tectonic upheaval at Fukushima. And 8 days later, the supermoon. I called it for the supermoon for a particular reason. Even though it's true that the velocity of the barycenter at the moment of the supermoon would have been at its minimum. Therefore, less than the speed of sound. I called it for the supermoon. Why? Because the whole attention of the human species was on the supermoon. Not everyone could see Fukushima. Not everyone was there to witness the accident. But the empirical evidence needed by the human animal to satisfy its proof-seeking hunger, its proof-seeking capacity, that empirical evidence was manifest in the sky over this planet to countless millions of people on March 19th, and that's why I called that day the onset of correction. That day was the first day of reset. In full manifestation, in full physical evidence before the eyes of the human species. And that's as it should be. Why? Because she cannot succeed with the ideal conditions of reset without some measure of human participation. So I called it for the 19th. All the people who saw the supermoon, all the amateur astronomers, all the people who talked about it on the media, all the people who blogged about it on countless astronomy sites, though they knew it not, were witnesses to the Nahual of the Wisdom Goddess. And it may well be that she as well released the tectonic pressure by the acoustic release of the at the moment of after the lunar apogee. Imagine that she came, the lunar apogee brought the barycenter around, swung it around, and as it came screaming around the curve where it reached its maximum velocity on the 6th, 5 days later, bam, it produced the tectonic upheaval that caused the nuclear disaster. The nuclear plants at Fukushima were man-made. And some people are going to argue to the end of time that the earthquake and tsunami that produced them were also man-made. You can't prove that they were, and you can't prove that they weren't. But I can assure you that the barycenter of the Earth reached its highest velocity on March 6th, 2011. That is a fact. So I'm going to leave it for there right now. I have to stop now and see if I can get my head together and calm down and find some serenity. I'm under a lot of pressure right now. Things are really breaking loose in the last month of the GNE. Things are breaking loose down at Ambergane House, and I'm feeling a certain amount of pressure due to the responsibilities and protocols of handover, which is now in full progress. So thank you for your patience and for your kind attention to what I have to say, regardless of how I say it. And I am intent upon keeping up the pace of these briefings for the remaining month, so I expect you'll be hearing from me again quite soon with NAV Briefing number 112.